journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. During the 1960s and 1970s, much of Africa won independence as Europeans withdrew from their former colonies. But there was one slice of the continent where that didn't happen. And that place is going to be the subject of today's show. I'm talking about the sparsely populated territory of Western Sahara. This is a Colorado-sized strip of land on the Atlantic Ocean in northwest Africa that had once been a Spanish colony. When Spain prepared to pull out in the mid-70s, the local people, known as the Sahrawi, thought they would get independence as well. But that's not what happened. Instead, today, around half of the Sahrawi population now lives in exile in a complex of refugee camps in Algeria, where they've languished for decades. Most of their native land is now occupied and administered by neighboring Morocco, whose troops invaded in 1975 with help from Mauritania. The Moroccans defend their gains behind a spectacular 1,700-mile-long sand berm that cuts through the desert and is fortified by the world's longest minefield. So if you haven't heard about Western Sahara or this giant wall, don't feel bad. There's almost no international news coverage of this conflict, and the reason there's so little coverage isn't an accident. We'll hear more about that later. But first, we're going to learn a little bit more about Western Sahara from Stephen Zunes. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, and he joins us now from California. Stephen, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, Stephen, I want to get to the current status of Western Sahara in a minute, but if you could, just take us back to 1975 when almost Africa was being decolonized. Explain why the Sahrawi people, these traditionally nomadic people that lived in Western Sahara, wound up missing out.
Well, they were certainly expecting independence because the Spaniards promised that to them. Unfortunately, however, the Moroccan government, along with neighboring Mauritania, had different ideas. Unfortunately, the United States pressured a reluctant Spain, then struggling with the transition after years of dictatorship under Francisco Franco, who was on his deathbed, agreed to hand the territory over, at least temporarily, to the and Mauritanian. The Moroccans ended up seizing the territory by force. The Polisario, which is the National Liberation Front, had been battling the Spaniards for a number of years, fought back. Over half the population was forced into exile in a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing. The Polisario eventually defeated the Mauritanians, but the Moroccans ended up taking over their third war, waged for quite a few years. But the main problem here was there was a similar situation actually to East Timor, a former Portuguese colony.
Well, I'm sorry, Stephen, if I could just stop you for a minute just to recap what you said. So you said that the Sahrawi, they formed this Polisario Front, this guerrilla group, to fight back against the Moroccan invasion. Ultimately, though, most of the Sahrawi were forced into exile in Algeria, but some did remain behind in Western Sahara.
Yes, they did, and they were brutally suppressed. The Moroccans imposed a totalitarian system. Any support for independence or any suspicion of pro-independence views was met by jailing, torture, extrajudicial killings. And the resistance has continued in one form or another ever since.
Okay, and how did the United Nations, how did the international community react to this?
The United Nations passed a resolution unanimously criticizing Morocco for the invasion and demanding that Morocco withdraw and allow the people of Western Sahara self-determination. However, the United States and France watered down the resolution, so it really didn't have any enforcement capabilities. Indeed, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, bragged in his autobiography that the task given to him by the State Department was to make the United Nations as ineffective as possible. And that he took upon that assignment with, in his words, no inconsiderable success. In other words, because the invasion was such a flagrant violation of the UN Charter, United States couldn't get away with saying it was okay, but they weren't going to allow the United Nations to enforce the resolution because the United States wanted Morocco to take it over. They saw the Polisario as too left-wing, you know, this is the whole Cold War mentality. If you're even slightly left of center, like the Polisario, they fear you might be communist or something, which they weren't, but you know, that was sort of the attitude at the time.
Okay, so Morocco, it sort of had this tacit green light from the United States, from France,
exactly,
to do this.
Exactly.
Obviously, there were Cold War factors at play here as well. But then, so there was this sort of long-running guerrilla war between the Polisario Front in the desert and the Moroccan army. There was this construction of this enormous wall through the desert. And then there was a ceasefire in 1991. Talk to us about that. What was the outcome?
Well, I should mention just briefly that by the early 1980s, the Polisario had liberated 85% of the territory from the Moroccans. But the United States and France dramatically increased military aid. The U.S. sent special forces as advisors into the occupied territories to help the Moroccans. So thanks to this increased U.S. and French aid, along with Saudi financing, the Moroccans were able to reverse the Polisario's gain, and it came into sort of a stalemate with the Moroccans controlling a little more than two-thirds of the territory. And that's when the ceasefire came into effect. The Polisario agreed that they would stop fighting as long as the United Nations would supervise a referendum on either independence or integration with Morocco. Unfortunately, though, that even though the Polisario honored their end of the agreement, and there's been no fighting since then, the Moroccans have refused to go ahead with the referendum, trying to stack the voter rolls with Moroccan colonists, who by this time outnumbered the remaining indigenous Sahrawi population. And once again, the United States and France blocked the United Nations from actually enforcing the resolutions that would have allowed the referendum to go forward.
Okay. Well, that takes us up to the present day. Stephen Zunis, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
My pleasure.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the frozen conflict in Western Sahara, often called the last colony in Africa. And one of the challenges for the Sahrawi people is that Morocco has essentially barred independent media from reporting inside Western Sahara. And so for more on this, we're going to bring in Naza El Khalidi. She's a Sahrawi journalist and activist who's part of a group called Equipe Media that tries to document human rights abuses in Western Sahara. She joins us now from Laayoune, the largest city in the part of Western Sahara controlled by Morocco. Naza, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jason. Do you hear me?
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you. And I wanted to ask you, first, as Stephen Zunis mentioned, about half the Sahrawi people ended up in refugee camps in Algeria. What is life like for those that stayed behind in Western Sahara, which is about 80% controlled by the Moroccan army now? What are some of the difficulties that people there face?
So, as you mentioned in the beginning of the program, Morocco invaded our country and invaded the people in Western Sahara, and the people of Western Sahara endured war and occupation. Even though there are very few people outside who have heard about our suffering and our tragedy. So since the Moroccan invasion started the tragedy of the people in Western Sahara, and it didn't stop until now. So we are talking here about the first disappearances. We're talking about more than 500 people who were disappeared after they were kidnapped by the Moroccan military during the war. We are talking about dozens of Sahrawis who have been in jails, tortured, and died under torture. We're talking about the people who were forcibly displaced from their country to Algeria. They were like looking for safe places while Morocco were bombing their homeland. We're talking about women, families. We're talking about members of whole families who spent 16 years in secret prisons inside Morocco.
Okay, and so Naza, you describe a very repressive state, a very repressive system targeting Sahrawi people. But let me ask you, so the Sahrawi, they're divided. So some of them are living in these refugee camps, around 100,000 in Algeria, and the remainder are living inside Western Sahara. How easy is it to communicate with other Sahrawi who are in the camps in Algeria?
So, you know, when just Morocco occupied the territory, most of the families just escaped from the occupied territory to the refugee camps. So they are our families. I'm talking about, for example, my family. I have like my uncles there, aunts there, and I've never seen them until 2017 when I got the chance to go there. So we're talking about like a very long period that the people couldn't communicate, couldn't like talk or know any information about their families in refugee camps until the technology development started. So the people start like using the internet, social media, and trying to travel through like different countries to reach the refugee camps through Mauritania or through like Spain to reach the refugee camps and meet their family after like many years. So this is how Morocco divided the country and the people through a wall which long as 2,700 kilometers. And it has like millions of landmines, interpersonal, which is a plan and a strategy that Morocco used to just continue his genocide against the people of Western Sahara.
So there's no direct transport, there's no direct communication links, at least until the advent of the internet. But Naza, if I could ask you about your practice of journalism and media activism, you and your colleagues have been trying to document human rights abuses in Western Sahara by the Moroccan authorities for several years, often using mobile phones. And you work through this Akeep Media Collective. The Moroccan authorities have not looked kindly on this. How do they treat Sahrawi journalists generally when you're operating in Western Sahara?
So the first thing that we have and the first challenges that we face, that we are under occupation. So we are only targeted by the occupation because we are just Sahrawis. You know that Morocco is denying our existence as a people in our homeland. So before we start doing this activism, which is being documenting the violations of human rights in the occupied territory of Western Sahara and the raise up the Sahrawi voice to reach the world, we are victims. Most of the members of, for example, my organization, which called Ekip Media, are victim of arbitrary detention, are victim of torture. All of them have no job. So this is like we found ourselves suffering in silence without nobody knows about what's happening here.
Well, let me ask you, if I could, about a protest that you tried to document last year. I believe it was in December. You were trying to stream on Facebook Live a protest by some Sahrawi people in Laayoon. And tell us a little bit about what happened to you.
So we are trying to break this totally blockade, media blockade and military blockade, which imposed on the territory of Western Sahara, trying to share information and what's happening here. And last December in 2018, I've tried to document how Morocco is using force and how Morocco is surrounding the streets and prevent the people from being in the streets protesting peacefully, asking for their fundamental rights, which are the right of self-determination and independence. And I was followed by police cars who were following me and beating me in the streets and just confiscate my phone, or actually they have stolen my phone, because when they took me to the police station afterwards, they interrogated me like for 4 hours without giving me any legal reason why they confiscate the phone or why I'm there. So just because I've tried to document and film for 4 minutes and the video is still on public, it's only 4 minutes.
And as I understand that you ultimately were charged with practicing journalism without a license. Talk to us about the outcome of that.
So the accusation came after. So after 3 months from being arrested, I received the call from the Moroccan court saying that the Moroccan king prosecutor gave me accusation which says that I claim to be a journalist, which is a profession which is regulated by the Moroccan law, but I don't have the right to practice journalism for Moroccans. I need to be authorized by the Moroccan government, which is not acceptable for me as a person first, as a Sahrawi who live under occupation and defend for the right of independence, and I'm not going to recognize the occupation, the illegal occupation of my country, and ask for authorization. And the second reason that Morocco is considered as a human rights defender and activist and journalist any as enemies. So they're not going to just give us authorization to work and to document what they are doing against the people in Western Sahara, because they spend many years just hiding the real reality from the world and trying to push and shoot down all the voices.
Well, Naza, we're gonna hear a lot more about this in a moment, but our time grows short. So I wanted to ask you as well about the dangers involved in this work. What strategies do you and your colleagues use to try to avoid being arrested, to avoid being detained while you're trying to videotape demonstrations, for example?
So since we are under the control of the Moroccan government and we are in the ground and working in the ground, we cannot say that we are 100% like protected or we're trying to avoid being arrested, because if Morocco wants to put us in jail, they are going to do that. But at least while we are documenting, we try, of course, to use the top roof to hide our cameras, because we are not allowed to show our cameras in the ground. We are not allowed to go in the street and filming the violations or filming the protesters while they are protesting. So we hide our cameras using the high buildings and filming, and sometimes the police just jump in on these buildings and catch the people and took like confiscate our materials. And this has happened with many of our colleagues, like the confiscation of our cameras. It's like it happens to us, and we face this kind of problems many times.
Well, Naza, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning. Please stay safe.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the disputed territory of Western Sahara. If you're interested in more Global Journalist, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. You can also find us on social media, subscribe to the podcast on Spotify or iTunes, or see our videocast on YouTube. So for more on why the outside world hears so little about this conflict, we're going to bring in two other guests. Joining us from Madrid, Spain is Alfonso Armada. He's the president of the Spanish branch of the press freedom group Reporters Without Borders. Alfonso, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
And also with us in Madrid is Maria Carrion. She's a former journalist for Democracy Now!, who's now the executive director of the Fisahara Film Festival, an annual event held in the Sahrawi refugee camps in Algeria. Maria, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Alfonso, if I could start with you. Your organization, Reporters Without Borders, put out a lengthy report this year calling Western Sahara a news desert. And we just heard about the difficulties that Sahrawi reporters face. What about for the international media?
Well, it's almost impossible for the international media to cover what's going on in the Western Sahara. I know personally journalists like Judith Pratt, a photographer, or Gervasio Sanchez, a photo reporter too. They try a few times to get inside, and after arriving to the territory, in a few hours, they are taken by the police and put out of the country. For foreign journalists, and Spaniards included, of course, it's almost impossible to be there and to write and photograph and to tell what's going on in the area.
If I could turn this to Maria Carrion, there has been this news blockade about Western Sahara. You run a film festival in the refugee camps. You also helped create this project called Watching Western Sahara to try to improve the quality of information that people are getting about this place. Talk to us about that.
The film festival is called Fisahara, and it takes place, as you said, in the refugee camps. It's a human rights film festival, but it also offers an entertainment. And what is unique about Fisahara is the fact that it's a once-in-a-year opportunity for a large project to hit the camps and raise awareness about international awareness about the conflict. During Fisahara, we have international media attend the festival. We have filmmakers come to the festival, and also general public from abroad come to the festival. Of course, the festival itself is for the Sahrawi refugees. It's a chance to sit in front of a big screen with families, watch films from all over the world, but also Sahrawi films, because in 2011, Fisahara also, with the Ministry of Culture in the camps, opened a small film school, which runs to this day. And in Western Sahara, the culture is majority oral, but young Sahrawis have taken the cameras and are beginning to produce authentic Sahrawi cinematography telling their own stories. So that's Fisahara. The next international edition will be held in April of 2020. And as far as Watching Western Sahara, this was a project that we created with the Witness Media Lab back in 2016. And now with our organization called NOMADS and also with the Berkeley Human Rights Investigations Lab, what we do is we take the videos that Nazha and her colleagues at Equipe Media, Smara News, and other media organizations that they film at so much risk. And we try to help international media and human rights monitors understand what happens in the video. So there's a whole verification process.
Right, Maria, because I know as a foreigner, you can find all sorts of videos online about Western Sahara, but you know, obviously sometimes there's like music playing over them. You don't know where the video is shot. You don't know exactly what is happening. Maybe you see some people getting pushed around or beaten by what look like police, but you don't know the context. You don't know if somebody maybe had just thrown a bottle. You don't know how, if you can trust all these videos that you see online from places like Western Sahara.
Right. And especially a few years ago in 2016, when we asked media and international media and human rights organizations, they really did want to use these videos, but they really did not understand what was going on in them. So by providing context with our partners on the ground in terms of what is happening, who's getting beaten up, why are people on the street in such a protracted way all over Western Sahara, what rights are they demanding and what rights are being violated? And by showing these videos in a context, it helps to sort of make them easier to use. We'll be launching the website, Watching Western Sahara website very soon. And in the meantime, there've been a lot of trainings as well all over the world for Sahrawi journalists to get better at recording in a safe way, in a more effective way, so that their targeted audiences abroad can understand their videos.
And Alfonso Armada, you heard Maria Carrion talking about this Watching Western Sahara project to make citizen journalism more accessible. But obviously, the mainstream press is still enormously influential for international public opinion. Talk to us about who benefits from this news blockade that you, that Nazha, have been describing. How does that play out in sort of this conflict?
Of course, Morocco. I think time plays on their hands. For the Moroccan media, they have not the chance to talk about Western Sahara. They don't use these words. They are talking about the provinces of the south. Is the how they are the government allowed then to talk about this the situation? But of course, for the authorities of Morocco, they are not interested in to know anything about what's going on because they are playing this game from for long. And Spain and other nations like France or the States are not working together to try to put to find a solution for this blockade.
And so, in other words, then, the more this stays out of the news, the more the status quo essentially takes hold, the harder it is to change things, it sounds.
Yes, Steven says something about that. Morocco just brought a lot of population from the north of the country in order if at the end of the day will be possible to organize this referendum. The census will be so supported by Morocco that at the end will be impossible for the Sahrawis to see and to show the nations that they wanted a free country.
And this is one of the interesting facets of this is that the population within Western Sahara now, it actually sounds like a majority are settlers from Morocco. So under some conditions, depending on who's allowed to vote, even in a referendum, people on the ground might choose to vote with Morocco because there are so many Moroccans that have moved there. And I do want to point out that we contacted the Moroccan embassy to get comment from the Moroccan government, get their perspective on this program. They did not respond to us. But Maria Carrion, if I could turn this back to you. You have spent a lot of time, as you mentioned, in Tindouf, in the refugee camps where people have been, in some cases, for 30 or 40 years. It doesn't seem like they're going back to Western Sahara anytime soon. What is the feeling there among the people?
It's a feeling of resistance. They're in constant resistance against everything. The elements, I mean, we're talking about a place that gets to be as hot as 50 degrees centigrade in the summer. Cultural resistance because people need to preserve their identity, their history, their culture in very difficult circumstances. Today, by the way, is the International Day of the Haima, which is the Sahrawi tent. And the reason why they celebrate today is because 9 years ago, the first Sahrawi tent was pitched right outside of the city of El Aaiun in Western Sahara. by a group of young people who wanted to challenge the occupation in a much more massive way. And thousands of Sahrawis joined them. And this became known as the Gdemi Zig camp. Some call it the beginning of the Arab Spring. It was violently dismantled a month later by Moroccan armed forces. And the Haima was banned from Western Sahara. So people cannot literally pitch their home tent in the occupied Western Sahara. So people in the camps act as a mirror. They say, okay, so we will be the people who will pitch the Haimas, who will raise our Sahrawi flag for our brothers and sisters, our family members in the occupied Western Sahara. But there's also a sense of despair. Young people who've never been there in their homeland, very little opportunity in the refugee camps, and total dependence upon humanitarian aid, which has been dwindling recently. No potable water or sanitation. The conditions are dire. And this is something the United Nations constantly repeats, including its Secretary General, that this conflict must be solved before it's literally a match that could blow up any time.
And Alfonso Armada, our time is almost up, but I wanted to give the last word to you. Morocco obviously feels like it has legitimate claims to this territory here, but as Maria highlights, the people that have been moved out of the territory, the refugees, have been there for decades and decades. Is there any reason for hope that there will be a peaceful and just resolution to this conflict?
Well, I like to remember what Portugal did with East Timor under control of Indonesia. Portugal media, Portugal society fight very hard trying to bring Timor people freedom, a free country. I think that Spain must do the same. There are many people in Spain that have the moral obligation that we promised the Sahrawis to become a free country, and we did not anything about that. We have to push back in order to give all these lonely people in the desert a hope and to bring a hope for a real country for them in the Western Sahara territory.
Well, that's interesting. So in other words, it sounds like you feel like Spain, because of guilt about the way it left its colony, has a special obligation to Western Sahara.
Yes, that was the reason that Reporters Without Borders decided to make this report. It's kind of our moral duty to do that.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Stephen Zunes, Naza El Khalidi, Maria Carrion, and Alfonso Armada for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Laura Miseres and Ariana Suardi. Trevor Hook is our supervising producer, and Benjamin Brink is visual editor. Takiya Thomas is audio engineer. Kathy Kiley is executive editor. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.